Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your Central Avenue sounds of music, news, and journalism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Been trying to get you alone for more than some time. It's been hard, but we made it this far. Now we're face to face, nothing's in our way. Won't you just stay for the rest of my life?
You guys feeling the jazz? The pseudo jazz, the neo jazz, the almost jazz. That was Ronald Bruner Jr., the older brother of Thundercat, for those of you playing bingo at home. And that is a song called One Night from his recent album called Triumph. Bruner is one of a bunch of LA jazz musicians, or post-jazz musicians, depending how you frame it, who have put out records recently. And I am joined this week by Giovanni Rusinello, who covers jazz for the New York Times. What's good, Gio?
What's going on?
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast. First time.
Yes, good to be
here. Long time listener.
Long
time listener. First time presence. There's a lot of things popping in Los Angeles.
Across the map.
You wrote a piece linking four of these records. We'll just say off top what they are. We have Uprising by Miles Mosley. We have Bruner's Triumph. We have Thundercat, who is Bruner's brother. We have his album, which is called Drunk, not Blem, it's Drunk. See, I told you I would do that. And then we have Cameron Graves's Planetary Prince.
That's right.
And so you wrote a piece talking about the four of those records. We're going to start with an engagement with those records, but then I also want to use this as an opportunity to go a little bit bigger. We'll talk about Kamasi, and we'll talk about Kamasi at the Whitney, and then we'll talk about institutions and we'll do a little coda at the end of institutions and jazz.
Perfect.
All right, so let's talk about the Bruner boys.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Bruner Jr.'s record and then Thundercat's record.
Yeah. Well, so this,
which we'll listen to it.
The piece you mentioned, which handled all four of those records, kind of wrote itself for me because
go read that.
Most of these albums were recorded together.
Yes.
You know, a few years ago.
And the sessions are, these are the sessions that also birthed the Kamasi Washington epic album.
Exactly. And they're
triple
from
vinyl.
What's being called the KSL sessions, which was sort of this month plus recording binge where all these musicians who were sort of making it on the LA scene, doing their thing outside the spotlight, pooled their resources, slept in the studio most of the nights, just went kind of crazy recording as much as they possibly could, maximizing their studio time in a really great studio in LA, and came out with, I'm sure, more albums than we're even aware of right now. We're going to keep seeing this trickle out over the next few years. So it's exciting to see them all kind of come out at once. It sort of signifies the amount that there is a cohesion and like a collective vision element to what's coming out of these guys in LA. They call themselves the West Coast Get Down. It is mostly guys. It's a jazz thing
that we
need to talk about in another podcast.
Another podcast. Natalie. We know you're listening.
Right. But yeah, these guys, Ronald Bruner Jr. and Thundercat, who both work in Kamasi Washington's band and are part of this West Coast Get Down crew, are really good kind of metonyms or, you know, people who represent like what it is that is making LA jazz fascinating right now and making it kind of thwarted to use the term jazz for this music.
And let's just for a moment, let's sidebar for the people who haven't listened to the epic.
Yeah.
Who haven't listened to that. A thing that I was struck by with these records, this latest group, is in some cases, they have very little to do with the epic.
Absolutely.
But they definitely exist under the cloud. Not the cloud is a bad word, but, under the umbrella of it.
Yeah, the shadow.
Sure. Yeah. That is the word.
Yeah.
So talk about why the epic was important.
Word.
And then let's use that as sort of the guide to talk about why these things are different.
The epic was important because it does loom like a cloud, but it also broke the clouds open on the LA jazz scene. It let the sun shine through, you know? And the epic, for, like you said, those who haven't necessarily heard it or aren't aware of it, is this album that came out of those sessions. It's by Kamasi Washington, the great kind of now standard-bearing jazz saxophone player out of LA, tenor saxophonist. And the album has an enormous ensemble, including a choir, I think something like 40 stringed instruments as part of this orchestra. And it is an enormous sounding record of enormous ambition. And that's kind of part of its appeal.
It's also very earthy.
It's
strange because it doesn't feel grand in that grand scaled way. It feels very grounded.
I know what you mean. I think that's the influence of sort of the diasporic beats that it has. I mean, whether you're talking about the Calypso influence or just the James Brown influence or the New York jazz influence, it's sort of a lot of rhythmic gravity is comprised in that record from all over the map of black music. And I should say, you know, global musics. I mean, I think Kamasi Washington has this, among other things, in common with John Coltrane. He's drawing very much globally. And I think there's this energy about the sessions that produced the record. You can sort of feel this like fibrous, like kind of vibration going on in the room. And it's something about the connection between the musicians. Yeah. It's very like, it's impossible for even to really write about it. I kind of gave it the old college try in a piece I wrote about Kamasi Washington specifically. But there's this magnetism between all the instruments, and it really is grounded, like you said, and it's the heavy atmosphere as well as sort of cosmic.
I went to one of those Blue Note shows. I think they were his first shows in New York with that band or a version of that band. And I remember being so struck because I don't go out to see as much jazz as I probably should. Mm.
Although I saw you at that Celle Bayonne show.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing my best.
Putting in the legwork.
Doing my best. But I feel like part of the thing, and I say this as a jazz novice, part of the thing that's always sold to me about jazz is like, oh, it's the way that they talk to each other on stage.
Right.
And I feel like I've gone to enough jazz shows where I'm like, that's not real.
Uh-huh.
That's not happening.
Well, then it's not working. Exactly.
Right.
You've probably been hanging out too much at the Blue Note.
Hey!
It's a hard place, man, for that stuff to come through. But if they could get it through at that venue, which is a tourist trap and an airplane hangar.
It's very rough.
Then,
but I was so struck when I saw them. Like you say, that texture and seeing not just the sonic texture, but literally just the way that they interacted amongst themselves.
I mean, it
on
epitomizes
stage.
Like it's all love, you know.
Yeah.
It really
I was so moved by it.
Right. It's really special.
So anyway, so that's the epic.
So that's
and
the
that's
epic.
The sort of cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have these sort of offshoot projects that are actually not really offshoots because they're the same.
Right. They're from
siblings.
That same ground. They're
for
the same soil.
Yeah.
And they came out, they sprouted at the same moment, really. And that is what's interesting is that, as you kind of mentioned, man, these all sound so different. None of them, except for maybe Cameron Graves' records, sound like anybody is trying to really move the dial forward on the jazz tradition specifically.
Yeah.
I would say Kamasi's does. I think people overestimate the amount that it's a quote-unquote crossover record. I think that's a function of the market and the market's reception of it more than the actual music. But I think most of these records, certainly the Ronald Bruner Jr. record, like no question, the Thundercat record, the other Bruner, sound like some kind of R&B and some kind of cosmic weirdo electronic expression.
And in what way is that consistent with the traditions of LA jazz?
That's exactly it, man. And I think the traditions of LA jazz have allowed for a lot of lateral movement on the part of all the musicians who want to go that way.
And we're talking different decades.
We're talking since at least, I don't know the history of, for instance, the 1950s and 60s crossover. I don't think that was happening as much. I know that there was things like Mingus's Jazz Workshop and a lot of grassroots kind of DIY musician organizing before that was an idea. It was just happening on the part of jazz musicians. But I think as soon as we started to see the commercialization of post-jazz musics, you know, you talk about fusion, R&B, and prog rock and that kind of stuff that was coming out in the 70s, LA was zooming ahead. And it was because the musicians, number one, had a lot of money coming in from studio gigs that were involved in TV, Hollywood soundtracking.
Which is a thing that is specific to LA. It was not something the New York jazz community really...
Not really, yeah. No. And the New York jazz community does have its own economy, but that economy is much more predicated upon maintaining a kind of purity and feeding the expectations of what jazz ought to sound like. LA, not so much. LA, you make your bread maybe doing a studio gig that involves soundtracking, like Stanley Clark, the great fusion bass player, has done more soundtracks than you could think of. And then you also are coming out of this jazz tradition. If you're like somebody who wants to take the potential of your instrument as far as you can go, you just learn jazz. You're an American musician. That's the way to do it. Then you've got a strong Afrocentric kind of artistic community that cross-pollinates between mediums and is super central to a lot of people's thinking and approach to their art in LA. And then you have... I kind of alluded to it. You have this impulse to bring all of it together and make a kind of fusion. Think about George Duke. Like I said, Stanley Clark, Patrice Rushen, a great vocalist, but mostly in the jazz world, we think of her as a piano player who made the song that became the Men in Black theme years later. that's her claim to fame for a lot of people, but she's had plenty of hits and is an amazing musician in a lot of ways. These people, many of whom directly mentored members of the West Coast Get Down, were... laying down,
which is this generation,
generation of people who are now in their late 20s, 30s. Those musicians in the 70s and 80s were saying it's all open, and the way to keep this music relevant, and they were saying this less didactically than that, but you know, the way this music works is that it's, you know, it reflects how we live our lives, who we know, what we're listening to on the radio, how we make our money, all those things, you know, what spiritually is feeding us, and it all comes together in a thing that naturally, I think, in L.A., progress alongside popular music and technology, right. Whereas in New York, like I said, a lot of commercial sort of siloing caused that stuff to get rooted a little more stringently.
To what degree does that period of time, and I mean by that the 70s and 80s, hover over this new set of records?
I would say it's not hovering over. I think it's feeding from below. I think it's really seeping into it in an organic way. And that's sort of what I've been thinking makes LA an exciting place in a similar way to places like Chicago, to a lesser degree. You know, people don't really think about St. Louis as much, but it had the Bag, the Black Artist Group, doing similar stuff. You've got a lot of less ballyhooed cities around the country where jazz kind of gets to take its natural evolution.
Right. Let's listen actually to a rather emblematic Thundercat song, which is called Show You the Way, which features LOL, Michael McDonald, and Kenny Loggins.
Thundercat's full of those LOLs.
Yeah. Or not LOL. We'll talk about
after
we listen to a little bit of that.
Not scared to die. Tell me.
Okay, so Gio, LOL or nah?
I mean, Thundercat has his tongue in his cheek at all moments. Yeah. What I liked about this record is that he's got, like, there's something else in his cheek. Like, he's, like, you know, he's probably got a cold, he's hungover, there's a cold sore in there, he's not feeling all that good, and he can't really hide that, you know? There's a melancholy that feels real about this album, and it shows that all these things that I think we've been told are silly or maybe compromising to the integrity of the music.
Yes.
Like a lot of these electronic sounds or
even of like vocal, like the vocal ranges.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like
to
these
be
things
a singing bass player is in jazz kind of a calculation or a compromise. But
yeah, I mean, the project of this album did seem at least in part to recover that which is maligned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I think he naturally does that. And I think he does it, luckily, thank God, he does it in a way that's not didactic and
right.
and really defensive.
Yeah.
He does it in a way that's like, yeah, we're going to laugh at ourselves. Yeah, we're going to let you laugh at all the things you're supposed to laugh at. And hopefully it's also going to affect you a little more and get a little further under your skin than you expected. You know, right after the Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins song is a song with Kendrick Lamar.
Yes.
So he's saying, you know, the dude who's the most serious musician on the planet, you know, Kendrick Lamar, mm-hmm. who's like, people don't question integrity of that guy ever,
right.
comes right after this tune. So he's sort of having it always, which is nice. And Thundercat, it's not like probably the greatest artistic statement of the 21st century, mm-hmm. but it's a great record.
Where do you place it on Thundercat record?
I think it's the best one, yeah.
I think it's the best one,
yeah.
too. Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was like an unpopular opinion
no,
or not.
No, I mean...
Because I've been very mixed on Thundercat to date. Like,
yeah.
I feel like Thundercat's a guy that I'm often told I should like, but,
yeah.
I don't always feel the same way. And I saw him perform at a festival last year, and I was kind of like, this is halfway to a thing,
mm-hmm,
but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's
no,
not
I feel
quite
you.
A thing. But this was the first one. It's the first one that felt, even though it's broken up into like 29 songs
yeah,
or whatever,
exactly.
but it's the first one that I felt completely
yeah.
felt of a piece.
I agree. And I think he's showing that, you know, no matter what kind of genre-oriented musician you are, you can make a record that feels a little bit like a mixtape and be doing earnest work.
Do you feel like Thundercat self-identifies in relation to the LA scene that we're talking about in a different way than the other musicians you wrote about?
That's a good question. Thundercat has a little bit less of the, you know, I'm speaking for a guy, but what... That's,
sure.
That's sort of
you
my
can
job.
Send,
I don't know.
Send an email. Send, email.
Yeah.
send an email. If we got it wrong, send
he
an
seems,
email.
He seems like a little bit less inherently disposed to the jazz musician's natural stance, which is one of interconnectedness, interdependence, selflessness, even as their protagonists. You know, Thundercat is like a bit of a dude who wants to hang out alone at the party. He's drinking heavily in the corner.
And
jazz musicians are not usually like that. They're not drinking heavily to begin with.
Right.
And they're not in the corner. They're kind of hamming it up. They're kind of the kinds of artists who are conspicuously sociable.
Mm.
You know, it's not really
That's interesting.
Of a piece with our American or Western notion of an artist.
Do you think that that also partially explains why his is the record that is not the record that comes from those sessions?
I think that's exactly it. And that's part of why he's... succeeded so much. He's maybe even more iconoclastic than the others, and he's much more naturally kind of given to doing his own thing. And, you know, maybe he'll surprise me and come out with the KSL Sessions record nobody knew about
sure.
in a month, and I'll be eating my words. But I think the guy is not the kind of dude who will be there hanging out all night for 30 days with his crew and like, okay, you guys took your turn, now it's my turn, all right, let's switch off. He's sort
right.
of like, I'm going to work on this at home for a few months and I'll come back.
Right.
Yeah, he's on his own trip.
So talk about how that approach differs from the Miles Mosley record and the Cameron Graves
yeah,
record, which do come directly from those sessions.
Miles Mosley, for instance, who's the bass player in the touring ensemble, the next step that Kamasi Washington has been going around the world with for the past, you know, basically 2 years. He came out with a new record. It is called Uprising, and it's very much a political and a kind of a call to arms record.
It's the most overt.
It's the most overt in every way.
Because I think of the Kamasi record as political, but in a far more implicit way.
Yeah, it's like, implicitly.
Yeah.
Like, I think almost all art is in some way political. Kamasi Washington's record comes out of a time where everyone's thinking about some things, and his life, you know,
lines
in some ways reflects that, as mm-hmm. he said. I would say that Miles Mosley's record wants to get you up out of your chair marching in the streets.
Yeah.
He wants his record to be played at the protests on the boombox. Which is cool. Very cool.
Let's listen to something from Uprising. Gio, what do you think is the most emblematic one for us to listen to?
I think a good one is Abraham, composition of his, because in part he's been playing this one at all the Kamasi Washington concerts. Kamasi usually takes a moment about halfway through to introduce the band, introduces Miles Mosley, says, you know, look out for this cat. He's really coming up. And then he has Miles lead the group in Abraham, which is this tune that's kind of got a biblical overtone, very grandiose, deeply grooving, wants to, like I said, kind of get you up and out and fired up.
Abraham, Miles Mosley.
You can call me Abraham, straight from the mountains of Jerusalem.
I got my shield, I got my sword. Forged from Egyptian gold. I'm fierce. I haven't cried in years. Sure enough, I'm scared. Mediocrity is everywhere, but not here.
Okay, so Uprising is an overtly political record.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit when you were talking about the Cameron Graves record. You talked about, I felt like earlier, maybe it was before we were recording, I feel like you were speaking about its relationship to the jazz tradition, that of this group of records, it was the one that had it most on the mind.
Yeah, it's the one with mostly acoustic instruments, some like a lot of tip and swing beats, ding, ding, ta-ding, you know? It's right. The one with the horn arrangements that sound like they could have been written in the 70s, but it's got an energy that definitely places it right now. Kamasi Washington takes some of his strongest straight-up post-bop solos on this record.
Okay.
It is also engaged in that kind of bigger conversation about what is this music for, you know? And for Cameron Graves, the piano player and composer who made this record, it's called Planetary Prince. That's what people also call him. He's a spiritual dude, and he's sort of got an Afrofuturist public persona. People talk about him a lot as the Planetary Prince, so he took that as the title of the album. He draws a lot of inspiration on this record from something called the Urantia book, which is this theological book that came out of Chicago in the early part of the 20th century, or I guess mid-20th century, really, that was sort of tying a lot of scientific and cosmological concepts directly to spirituality. Huh. And it's sort of a wonder that this hasn't surfaced more in jazz conversations and Afrofuturist conversations. Its authors were white, but it definitely deals with a lot of like the kind of cosmological ideas that this music is after. And so that gives you a sense of how it can be within the tradition and inheriting a lot of these kinds of, I mean, that's a Sun Ra idea right there, straight up. I'd be amazed if Sun Ra didn't read the Urantia book himself. But it also is dreaming big, you know, in a way that sort of feels infinite. And that comes through in the music.
And in what way do Miles Mosley's politics and the cosmology that Cameron Graves is interested in and the Bruner Brothers' interest in sort of a sound with melted edges?
I get that.
In what way do those things all talk to each other?
I get that. I would kind of caution against fitting too much into the thesis because I think the Bruner Brothers deserve to be left out of that a little bit.
Okay.
They're not so much operating directly in that conversation, although there are songs on which Ronald Bruner Jr. is. You know, we're in a time where the imagination feels especially necessary because what's going on in the real world feels especially dispiriting to a lot of people.
Sure.
So I think that's where the Afrofuturist impulse kind of came out of to begin with, and that's why we see it as a really sustained strand of artistic inspiration, because people are really trying to say a lot of our power comes from our ability to see beyond what's so screwed up right now.
Right.
And I think that's what gives Cameron Graves's album, to me, an even greater sense of openness and possibility than the Mosley record. The Mosley record gives you more of like a pat impact. And then the Cameron Graves record opens up real wide.
It's a vibe.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I feel like we started a little bit earlier talking about what Kamasi brought to the broader conversation about jazz and also about Los Angeles. I think we should pivot a little bit because there's an interesting thing that's happened with Kamasi recently, which is he is one of the featured artists in the Whitney Biennial.
That's right.
Which is something else that you've written about and spoken with him about. To the best of my understanding, this is the first time a jazz musician was chosen as a displayed artist.
Nope. Two biennials ago, Jason Moran.
Oh, sure.
And his bride and kind of co-conspirator in most things artistic, yes. Alicia Hall Moran. True. Took over an entire floor at the Old Whitney.
Okay.
And that is part of what's exciting about this moment in the music is that Jason was sort of the obvious choice then. Kamasi is definitely the obvious choice now.
Yeah.
But the fact that the museum that purports to represent what's going on in American art right now and tries to stay as Akoran as possible is kind of keeping up its engagement with the art form is an indication that jazz ain't
so
dead.
We're about 3 years away from famous Dex. In the Whitney Biennial.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay,
you go.
Great. I can't wait. Smoke, perp, and Lil Uzi. Someone
jazz
book,
music, man.
Oh, that's jazz.
There you go.
It's SoundCloud. It's the jazz of SoundCloud.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about what Kamasi is doing with this platform.
So Kamasi is very much in that same strand of thought, as Cameron Graves. He wants to dream big. He wants to encourage others to sort of have a grounded optimism.
Yep.
And this piece at the Whitney Biennial, which if you're anywhere near New York, you should go see, not just for the Kamasi piece, but also because, man, what an exhibition.
A lot going on there.
There's a lot going on. So the Kamasi piece at the Biennial is a 35-minute long suite of six compositions that are accompanied by a video.
Original compositions.
New compositions that are very much in the vein of the epic. And they're accompanied in the gallery by a video from A.G. Rojas, who's this young L.A.-based music video director. And the way it's set up is, I mean, overtly emblematic of how Kamasi Washington wants his music to make an impact, which is that there's three screens on different walls showing the first five videos, and then the final video, which is the sixth piece, is on a different wall. And when the first five videos are done, first five tunes, those screens go blank, and everyone has to kind of gather together to watch the last one.
Oh, cool.
So the idea is, you know, plurality, difference, bring it together. The piece is called, again, quite clearly and overtly, The Harmony of Difference. And it's just a beautiful piece of music that really doesn't hold back. It's about beauty, expansiveness, togetherness, and consonance.
Sidebar. Is that music available? Like, can we play
it? No, that music is not available. I think the idea is for it to become available later, but this is entirely cruel to those of our listeners who aren't in New York. There's no shot.
Okay. So even though the Morans were in this position, it's still not totally a conventional use of the Whitney Biennial or a big art institution to recognize jazz in this way. I feel like sometimes I'll get these press releases from museums where they have like concerts and they're, you know, it's like in a quiet room in a very fancy building.
Totally.
Someone will play very controlled music for 45 minutes.
Kamasi Washington is the first jazz musician that I can think of who has entered the Academy of Museums in a big way without spending years or probably decades getting big grants from the Doris Duke Foundation, being a professor at Harvard, doing whatever it is that he's doing to sort of already be a household name amongst the cognoscenti of the academies that exist in this country.
Right, and those become sort of proxy prizes, if you will, for a certain type of jazz musician.
It becomes super obvious that they would choose
who
this person.
Who is the favored person,
right?
You know,
and you know,
MacArthur grants.
And what's heartening, and you know, as a jazz person, you try not to put too much stock in this because, man, we've been ground down so much.
Yeah, sure.
we've learned to temper our enthusiasms and our hope. But at the same time, like,
give a jazz guy a hug next time, next time you see one. Give him a hug.
it's cool to see a guy who's been touring rock clubs around the world go straight into the Whitney.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, jazz guys don't tour rock clubs around the world.
Yep.
And second of all, the guys that get into the Whitney, and then you have to pay a bajillion dollars to go in and see the exhibition. Right. I mean,
are
that's
you
still
sure? Because I saw La La Land, and there was definitely a jazz group that toured rock clubs.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't think
they were the villains,
yeah,
right?
You didn't think we were going to get all the way through this podcast.
Oh, yeah, they were evil.
Without, yes, no.
Yeah, they were really bad. They were really screwing up jazz trying to play it in rock clubs.
Shouts to that boy, John Legend.
I know.
So,
poor guy.
Okay, it's an interesting moment to speak about the ease with which someone like Kamasi has found his way into those institutions.
Right.
Because at the same time that has happened, and an opposite thing is happening, which is there is a risk that the National Endowment for the Arts, which was one of the sort of marquee things for jazz musicians who are
right.
not, you know, pop stars that are on the radio, there's, you know, but this is a thing that has sustained
yes.
many an important jazz performer and also many an important jazz institution that nurtured dozens of other performers. Tell us a little bit about the role of the NEA historically in supporting jazz, and then we'll talk about what's happening now.
Counterpoint, then point. How's
yes.
that? The NEA has not always shined its light on people outside of New York and outside of the jazz
yeah.
ecosystem that we think of as sort of the mainstream in a way that is satisfying. And I think everybody knows that about the NEA.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much part of that academy that you would rise through in order to get to a place where you're playing at the Met.
It's sort of self-replicating. It's like a self-perpetuating.
Yeah, it's part of that
ideology. And
that commercial ecosystem, you
yeah.
know, pseudo-commercial, I guess, because it's grants, not ad
right.
sales. But, you know, whatever it is, it all kind of comes out in the wash. That said, the NEA is super crucial in terms of supporting and bringing this music to young people and making sure that the kinds of public events that make jazz as much a part of our kind of collective understanding of this country's culture.
Of American cultural
yeah,
memory. Yeah,
exactly. That make it what it is. The NEA is really doing a lot. I mean, it gives out almost $3 million in jazz grants a year, and 40% of its grant-making budget goes to regional groups that and state arts groups
mm-hmm.
that then disperse grants to other jazz projects. So the $3 million is not even the ceiling. And it is extremely meaningful for musicians to be called NEA Jazz Masters. It's been going on now for 35 years,
mm-hmm.
and it's taken on this place in the jazz world where it means a whole heck of a lot, and it's seen as a big slight for some older jazz musicians not to get that.
So who are some examples of folks who have gotten it, and who are some examples of folks who have not gotten it?
This year we saw Dr. Lonnie Smith, who is an organ player who, you know, was part of sort of the soul jazz movement in the 60s. You know, the organ lends itself to that Jimmy Smith tradition. He's now had a renaissance in his own career over the past 10 or 15 years, just seen as a very important elder, somebody who really has his own sound. Bridgewater is a vocalist, came up in the 70s and 80s, who hosted a NPR program called Jazz Set for over 20 years, is just a really major public persona in jazz, has done stage productions, recorded a lot of Grammy-winning albums,
mm-hmm.
just a major figure as well. Dave Holland is a bass player who has gone from the avant-garde to fusion to straight ahead, played with Miles back in the day, is just... He's an unquestionable luminary.
Right.
Those are the kinds of people.
And then you were saying that there are some people at the NEA.
So the people, okay, yeah, the other part
of
the question.
Of identifying.
The NEA hasn't identified, I mean, people who died without NEA Jazz Masters Awards are people like Horace Tapscott, who
mm-hmm.
was major in the LA jazz scene and mm-hmm. is considered a huge figure for people like Kamasi and Cameron Graves. Fred Anderson is just somebody else I mentioned in the article who ran a jazz club, lived into his 80s out in Chicago, was a founder of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, and never got it, and that's amazing.
So the NEA is flawed, but what if it goes away? Because
exactly.
here we are.
Why would we want it to go away?
Right. So flawed or not, maybe we want it to be better, but we don't want it to disappear.
Yeah.
So
and I think
when
that
Donald Trump's first budget proposal came out, there are many, many programs that were cut across numerous areas of American life.
Right.
But the arts and the humanities were there in a very serious way. And the initial budget says that he would fund the National Endowment of the Arts and the National Endowment of the Humanities at zero.
Yeah. He wants to get...
Not a little.
Right.
Zero.
Yeah.
So, worst case scenario, the NEA goes away for 4 years, assuming that whoever comes after brings it back. Talk a little bit about what you feel the trickle-down effect into jazz might look like.
That is really hard to speculate on. I would probably need to know a full accounting of all the organizations that depend on that money, but I think most do because, like I said, the NEA either funds people directly or funds state organizations and regional organizations that then fund other nonprofits that are doing presenting work or are doing educational work or in some way are feeding the jazz ecosystem. So I think the impact would be widespread.
It would make it harder to be a working jazz musician. It would make it harder if you were out of a jazz center to have access to
reasonable
quality performances.
Yeah, I think so. I think that jazz musicians get paid now according to their, in a meritocratic way, according to their proficiency and according to the value of their art, not according to their ability to draw a crowd.
Yeah.
I think that's wrapped up in a lot of conversations about whether commercial institutions are prepared to really promote strong and meaningful art that goes against the grain. And as a result of the answer to that often being no, over the past few decades, we've really seen a privatizing of a lot of media and like a deinvestment in public media and along the way, like a sort of forgetfulness around a lot of creative music. So with all that going together, people aren't able to pay jazz musicians to perform what they need to be paid in order to make a living. You need grants. You have a grant economy that is sort of prosthetic or, you know, not entirely natural, but is the best hope we've got right now for keeping a lot of important musicians in the world working.
It's like duct tape.
It is. It really is. It's holding it together. And, you know, I guess we could let that go and just let the market drive things, but you're out there listening. What do you think?
Oh, I love the market. I love the market. The market is rad.
Yeah.
The market is rad. All my favorite things come out of the market.
Well, hey, there you go.
I have learned after many years of capitalist and then also anti-capitalist theory that the market is imperfect and we have to protect things that
it works in concert.
Can be easily victimized by a predatory
market.
All right, with that in mind, let's listen to something that's a little bit nourishing and a little bit generative, and that will hopefully restore or at least offer the possibility of a tiny bit of hope in an otherwise bleak sociocultural landscape. So let's listen to something from the epic Kamasi's record. What do you want to hear?
How about something that will maybe surprisingly get in people's heads and stay wedged in their ear for a week? There are still some pop tunes in jazz. The Rhythm Changes.
That's right. Tell them why you're mad, Gio.
There you go.
All right, The Rhythm Changes, Kamasi Washington. Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. Thank you to my guest, Gio Russinello, first but not the last time, talking all that jazz. You can read Gio on jazz and also me writing a very uninformed thing about Thundercat at nytimes.com/music. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with any questions that you might want us to answer on a future podcast. Subscribe to the podcast because I know that's what you need to do at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere that you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We are out and back next week.